This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. For 9 years, historian Gerald Prokopovich served as scholar-in-residence at the Abraham Lincoln Museum in Fort Wayne, Indiana. As such, he answered lots of questions from museum visitors, some perceptive, some provocative. On the program today, we're going to talk with him about Abraham Lincoln. It's your chance to ask a question you've always wanted to ask about our 16th president. Our guest, Gerald Prokopovich, is the author of the new book, Did Lincoln Own Slaves? And other frequently asked questions about Abraham Lincoln. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Gerald Prokopovich chairs the History Department at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. He's a member of the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Commission Advisory Committee. He is the author of All for the Regiment, The Army of the Ohio, 1861 to 1862, and he was the editor of Lincoln Lore, the quarterly journal of the Lincoln Museum. His book, Did Lincoln Own Slaves and Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln, is published by Pantheon Books. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers this afternoon if you'd like to join us. Gerald Prokopovich, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Celeste, for having me.
My pleasure. Well, what gives rise to this question, did Lincoln own slaves?
Well, it's a good question itself, because the answer is very simple, which is no. He was born in Kentucky, which was a slave state, but he moved to Indiana at an early age, and that was a free territory and became a free state. And, of course, he lived much of his life in Illinois, which was a free state, and then went to Washington, D.C., and he's not likely to have bought slaves there. So the answer is simply no, but people keep asking this question. And I think there are two reasons why it comes up, one of which is that we tend to be skeptical of heroes today. We look at the great figures in American history like George Washington and recognize he was a slave owner. Thomas Jefferson, he owned slaves. What about Abraham Lincoln? Did he own slaves too? I think that's where some of it comes from.
And then you say also in the book, in answer to this question, it is a surrogate. That question, did Lincoln own slaves, is a surrogate for a larger, much more substantial question. That question is, you know, was he the great emancipator or was he a racist?
And that's really the second source of that question. You're absolutely right about that. That it comes from a skepticism about Lincoln, that perhaps he is not the great hero people have been taught to think he was. I think that skepticism comes from a perhaps misreading of the evidence in light of modern standards, but it is a question that people ask. They wonder if Lincoln should be regarded as the great emancipator, partly because Lincoln has for so many years been given too much weight to carry by the public, particularly in the North, as the great emancipator. If we look at Lincoln and say, well, the work is done, slavery ended, Lincoln gave his life for the cause, there's nothing more we need do, then in doing so, that overlooks all the racism and segregation that followed his life. And it's a backlash against that complacency that I think causes some people to look critically at Lincoln's record.
Yeah. Where do historians stand on the question today?
For the most part, traditional Lincoln historians have been, of course, very sympathetic to him, and I think appropriately so, but maybe carried it too far, so that we've seen in the last few years a backlash, not so much from historians, but from writers with an interest in history who also have an interest in other issues, political and economic, that they then transport into the historical arena. So we've got, on the one hand, writers like Lerone Bennett, who wrote Forced into Glory in the year 2000, that attacks Lincoln for being too slow to emancipate the slaves, and thus is critical of him. From another quarter, there are writers with libertarian sympathies who attack Lincoln for leading the federal government in defeating the southern states. And both these attacks on Lincoln have to come to terms with the fact that slavery did come to an end, and nobody wants to argue that's a bad thing. So they have to try to disassociate Lincoln from emancipation. And thus, if you can imply that Lincoln wasn't really sympathetic to the slaves, didn't really care for them, and by the way, maybe he owned slaves, suddenly that question is out there.
What do you think are the, maybe you'd name for us a couple of the best books about Lincoln that are available today?
Well, there are a lot of books.
So many.
More than 14,000, according to one count. It's an incredible number. One reason I wrote this book was that people often ask me, well, what should I read about Lincoln? And the short answer is read this book first. But after Did Lincoln Own Slaves, there are so many books on each topic. If you were going to read one single one-volume biography of Lincoln, you could certainly do a lot worse than David Herbert Donald's book, Lincoln, published in 1995. For a shorter version, a little out of date but beautifully written, there's Benjamin Thomas's one-volume book, Abraham Lincoln, written in 1952. Those are places I would start for just the best outline of the whole Lincoln story.
Yeah. How did you decide you would do this book? It's so, forgive me for using this term, it's so user-friendly and it's so much fun. You can just dip in and you know, before you know it, you've passed an hour or two.
Well,
how did you decide this would be useful for people?
Well, partly it came from my experience at the Lincoln Museum in Fort Wayne, Indiana, that people ask questions all the time. They would see the exhibits, and it might trigger another question, or I would give a talk to a Kiwanis Club or some other group, and there'd be questions. And the ones that kept coming up, I thought, those are worth answering. And it really struck me that the questions the public asked were not always the same questions that my professional colleagues would discuss at, say, the Organization of American Historians meeting or the Lincoln Forum. And I thought there's a need for a book that answers these public questions. There are plenty of books scholars are writing for one another all the time. But what about the questions people want to know? Did Lincoln own slaves, for example, is a question no historian would need to ask, because we all know, of course, he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that the question survives, as you point out, as a surrogate for other issues, means it ought to be answered. And if the historian doesn't answer it, then a filmmaker is going to do so, or a journalist, or someone not trained in the field. And I think historians have an obligation to the public to communicate with everyone, not just their professional colleagues. And I'm afraid we do that a little too much.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Gerald Prokopovich, and he is the author of Did Lincoln Own Slaves and Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We take a call now from a listener in Belgium on line one. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
I'd like to bring up an aspect of Lincoln that nobody really talks about too much. And that's the fact, over here in East Central Illinois, a small town named Danville, Mr. Lincoln spent some time on the circuit coming through this area. And one of the reasons he came through this area was because he was a railroad lawyer. And they weren't known to be particularly nice people in those days, were they?
Well, he was a railroad lawyer, but he was also an anti-railroad lawyer.
Oh.
He had a very wide practice. The Lincoln Legal Papers Project, recently completed, published all the papers they found in Illinois in courthouses relating to Lincoln's legal practice.
Yes, several of them came from Danville.
And many did, and they thought they would only find a few thousand documents. They ended up finding 100,000 pages of material, and Lincoln's practice was very wide and varied. He did represent the Illinois Central Railroad in some famous cases, but in at least one of them, he offered his services to the county that was going to court with the railroad, and they declined it, so then he went to work for the railroad instead. He was not committed to the railroad as a single source of income or a single client, and his practice included murders and divorces and stray animals, as well as railroads and corporations.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Next, we take a listener call from Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just had a question about Lincoln's past with regards to minority groups and whatnot. We know that he was very critical in freeing the slaves. But before that time, he spent time in the military in Illinois during the time of the Black Hawk Wars, a time when there was a great number of atrocities committed against the Native Americans. How can we separate his potential involvement in putting down this one group, but at the same time raise him up for freeing the slaves? Isn't there some sort of conflict there? And I will take my answer off air.
Okay.
It's an excellent question. Lincoln did serve in the Black Hawk War in 1832. He joined the militia, as did all the other young men in the area at the time, New Salem. He did not participate, as he later said in a speech in Congress, in any combat, and he never saw, as he put it, a live fighting Indian. So he was not part of the actual warfare, although he was certainly in the service. The one story that comes down to us of his service is the time a lone Indian came into the soldier's camp, apparently looking for food, and the other boys with Lincoln began to attack or planned to attack him and thought they would kill him because finally they'd seen an Indian. And Lincoln intervened and said, "You can't hurt this man. He's defenseless. He's not part of the war," and prevented an atrocity in that one case. Now, beyond that, I think that the point is well taken, that Lincoln is part of his larger society, that he serves in a militia that's part of a war between white and red people on the Illinois frontier. But he individually didn't take part in any atrocities and would not have countenanced them. During the Civil War, there was a huge rebellion on the Minnesota frontier, the Sioux Rebellion in 1862, after which the Indians who were taken prisoner were ordered to be put to death. Some 330 were to be executed. And Lincoln again objected to this. By this time he was president, and he insisted that all the execution orders be reviewed individually to see if the Indians had actually committed war crimes, violence against civilians, or if they were simply fighters. And those who were simply fighters he pardoned. That was about 300 of them, and the remainder were executed. But he lost a lot of votes in Minnesota for pardoning 300 Indian rebels.
Interesting. Let's take another call. A listener in Eureka, Illinois. Line 2, hi.
Good afternoon. A very interesting program. My memory has it somewhere I read or heard that Lincoln favored sending back slaves to Liberia in Africa and letting them establish their own country. And I guess that would be one part to the question. The other part was I believe I read or heard somewhere that Lincoln did not believe that black people were the full equals of white people, though he was opposed to slavery. Could you comment, please?
Your memory is pretty good on both points, but as always, the answer is more complicated than first blush. As to the second point on colonization, Lincoln and his whole generation, including many who were anti-slavery, were not very clear on what would happen after the end of slavery. The idea that there could be a just multiracial society on the scale of the United States was just not in the vision of many people in the 19th century. Nothing like it existed anywhere in the world. Lincoln once said that he did not see how the races could live in perfect equality. And where some people quote that to show Lincoln a racist, I think a more accurate vision would be to say Lincoln was a good predictor, because we have not yet proven that we can live in perfect equality. We still struggle with racism and injustice. So Lincoln was not saying he believed in inequality, but rather that he didn't see what we could do, and we haven't proven him wrong yet. Now, as to this issue of inequality, what people cite in that regard and what might be triggering your memory here are some comments Lincoln made during his famous debates with Stephen Douglas in 1858. In those debates, on several occasions, Lincoln explicitly said, "I do not propose social and political equality between the races. I simply want the end of slavery." And taken out of context, it does seem that Lincoln is racist, is arguing for inequality. But if you look in context and read what Stephen Douglas is saying in those debates, he's arguing for a radically racist vision of America. He explicitly says this is the white man's country. He explicitly says black people are inferior and have no rights. He is very clear in his racism in language no political figure could imagine, possibly imagine using. He uses the N-word repeatedly in his speeches. That's the atmosphere in which Lincoln says, now hold on, I'm not saying I want political equality, which he knows the audience would never tolerate, but I am saying that the slave is entitled to eat the bread that he earns with the sweat of his brow, just as I am and Judge Douglas is and any man here is. So while he does qualify what he's saying to pander to the racism of the audience, the underlying heart of his sentence is that he objects to racism or objects to slavery. And that's a strong statement for that era.
Do you believe he may have been couching his language, or maybe you said that, to be more political appealing to some of his crowds in Illinois?
Oh, absolutely. If you trace the seven debates with Douglas, he speaks differently in Galesburg than he does in Ottawa, than he does in Charleston. As he goes south through the state, his language refers more frequently to racial differences. And as he goes further north, he repeats more often the language of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal. In the last debate at Alton, he returns to his initial theme and rejects, he leaves out the discussion of racial differences and reprises a speech he made at Chicago a year earlier, in which he says, let us discard all this quibbling about this race and that race, this man and the other man being inferior and must be put in an inferior position. He says, let's discard all this and return to the standard our fathers left us, mm-hmm. the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal. So yes, he did play to the political winds of his time in those debates, but when he got back to his deeper principles, he did much better, both in our view and politically at the time.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. We've got another listener standing by to talk with us, but before we do that, I want to follow up on this, what we've just been talking about, and this was a question that I found very interesting in the book. What was his greatest speech? It's a great question, and you say one of his greatest speeches had to have been a speech he delivered in Peoria in October of 1854, and you say this speech was a powerful attack on slavery that had the political virtue in 1854 of ignoring the slaves themselves.
Well, that was something Lincoln had to do. That is it is a great speech. It does encompass all the themes he will follow up on in the debates and then his presidential speeches. But Lincoln was aware that the electorate was all white, and most of them were racially prejudiced. It was a white political world that he was living in. And he found that he could make a strong appeal against slavery without appealing to sympathy for the slaves. That is to say, you can oppose slavery for many reasons without believing in racial equality. You can oppose it because if slavery takes root in the Western territories, then free labor won't take root, and if you're a free farmer, you can't move out there with your farm because it's slave territory and you can't compete with that. You can oppose it because you simply don't like African people anywhere, whether they're free or slaves, so you can be against slavery on those grounds. You can be against it even more importantly, more politically, because slavery is so contradictory to American ideals. If we believe in the idea that all men are created equal, and if we believe in economic opportunity and rising by one's own virtue, one's own hard work, slavery undercuts that. Slavery allows one person to work and the other person to benefit. If we believe in democracy, in resolving our differences through debate in council, slavery undercuts that because the slave owner is accustomed to having his word be law and using the lash to enforce it. Slave owners are not fit to be participants in our republic, because their values are those of violence, coercion, oppression. So you can oppose slavery for all those reasons. You can oppose slavery because it undercuts our example to the world. We claim to be the land of freedom, yet other nations taunt us as hypocrites because we have slavery. Lincoln makes all those points in the Peoria speech, and it is really a great speech.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Good morning, or good afternoon. I wonder, one thing, I just read a book, One Man Great Enough, Abraham Lincoln's Road to the Civil War. I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
It's a new one, and I haven't read it yet. I look forward
okay,
to it.
Okay, it strikes me as being very good. But and Lincoln is one of those people I have, about the only person I have unalloyed admiration for as a political person and a human being. And he also said, when you're talking about, he said, if slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. You probably know that one, too. What I was wondering about is, two things, I guess. Gore Vidal wrote a book about Lincoln. You happen to be familiar with that one?
I am quite familiar with that one, yes.
I was just wondering, did you think that the way he portrayed Lincoln in that book, which is kind of as one element or a crowning element in a sort of a bigger story about what has happening in America, and of course nobody escapes from the spirit of his times. Lincoln was a man of his times, right? I mean, his views weren't that sophisticated in terms of like race and such, do you think? What's your thought?
Well, they weren't, but I would say that Gore Vidal's book, one of the questions that I answer in the book is a counterpart of Celeste's first question about what's a good book to read about Lincoln, what's a bad book, what's the worst book about Lincoln. And I would vote Gore Vidal's Lincoln as the runner-up of the worst book about Lincoln competition, in part because it's so beautifully written, it's so intriguing and fascinating. But what the author did there was to read a lot of Lincoln sources and then take sources from stories, from accurate Lincoln sources and dependable ones, and from less reliable sources, and combine those, and then stories he made up altogether himself, dialogue he made up altogether, and mix them all together with his wonderful prose in such a way that it's impossible, almost impossible for the expert even, to untwine the threads and figure out what's real, what's unreliable but might be real, and what's completely fantasy. So many people who've only read that book about Lincoln will never quite have a clear picture of what the real Lincoln was like and what is the picture of the novelist's imagination.
In the way you frame it, I agree with you. Well, it's been an interesting conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to Terre Haute, a listener on line 4. Hi.
Hi. Can you tell me if Lincoln ever offered any observations with regard to women's rights?
He did. In an early political editorial he wrote, and he was running for the state legislature, I think it was 1836, maybe 1834, he laid out his views in which he said, I call for all white people, this is an age before the idea of black voting was even being talked about, all white people should have the right to vote if they pay taxes and bear arms. And then he writes in parentheses, by no means excluding females. Now, this is as close as Lincoln ever came to discussing women's rights, and some writers have seized on it and said, yes, Lincoln was for women's rights. My suspicion is that this is an example of Lincoln's humor, because when he talks about paying taxes or bearing arms, the number of females who pay taxes is very low, because most of them don't own property. If they're married, their husbands own the property. And the number of females who bear arms, in the sense of being part of a well-regulated militia, is zero. None of them bear arms. In that constitutional sense. So he's really making a joke. Sure, you can vote if you're a woman, as long as you're in the militia like all the men are. It's not an anti-woman joke. I think it's just a sidelight. Beyond that, Lincoln didn't talk about it. It was an issue. It was starting to become an issue. Of course, a women's rights conference was held at Seneca Falls, late 1840s. But we can only speculate that given how Lincoln reacted to the oppression of African Americans, that it's hard to imagine he would have tolerated indefinitely unequal rights for women. He once said in a letter to Joshua Speed, how can any person who abhors the oppression of Negroes be in favor of the oppression of groups of white people? And there he was referring to non-Christians or to non-Protestants, but he might well have been referring to non-males at some point, too.
Okay. You want to follow up, listener?
No, thank you very
okay.
much.
It's a long question. Answer to a short question. It really was not an issue that he chose to engage, so we don't know exactly what he would have thought.
Let's continue to take some calls. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question relating to Lincoln's religious beliefs. Years ago, I ran across a book in the University of Wisconsin Whitewater Library written by a contemporary French reporter who had traveled with Lincoln for a time, I think during the Lincoln-Douglas debate. And apparently at one point they were together alone in a railroad car. And Lincoln began to question him about the religious beliefs of intellectuals in Europe. And the Frenchman described the prevailing deist beliefs of the time, or perhaps post-deist. And Lincoln apparently said, well, that was about his conclusion. Does this sound like a reliable report of Lincoln, or what's your opinion? I've never been able to find the book yet.
That's too bad. I'd like to know which one it was. I don't recognize it immediately from your account. But Lincoln's religion is a very much debated topic, and one that's been talked about much over the last 150 years. It doesn't sound like an entirely implausible conversation, but except for the fact that Lincoln didn't talk much about his religion, his law partner William Herndon, after Lincoln died, went back and tried to meet all the people Lincoln had known as a young man in New Salem and elsewhere and ask them questions. And one of the standard questions Herndon always asked was, did Lincoln say anything about religion? What were his religious views? Which means that here's Herndon, who had been every day in the same office with Lincoln for more than 10 years, 15 years, didn't know what Lincoln's religious views were and was curious to know from others what they were. Lincoln was not open about it. What we do know is that he never joined a church, never formally belonged to any religious organization, on the one hand, but on the other hand, that he refers to God and the Almighty in his speeches, notably the second inaugural address and the Gettysburg Address, more than any other American president, or certainly more thoughtfully than any other American president ever has. So there's a real contradiction there. He clearly had very strong spiritual beliefs, but they were not conventional beliefs. He rarely referred to Jesus, but frequently referred to Providence or God or the Almighty. There was a single Old Testament God in Lincoln's world, but not a conventional Christian theology.
Does the listener want a follow-up?
Well, it's interesting. Maybe it's worth my time trying to go through our library here and try to find that volume again.
I'd sure be interested if you did. Send me a note if you find it.
Well, I shall try. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. For a time, I lived in Springfield, and the story I heard in Springfield about Lincoln and church was that the family went to church, but Mr. Lincoln did not. Is that correct?
That could be correct. Well, it is correct. Mary Lincoln joined the Presbyterian Church, and they rented a pew and as a family, and she was a member, but he was not a member. And in Washington, D.C., he did begin to attend church with his wife, but still did not actually join. And there was quite a distinction in those days between showing up and being an actual member of the body of the church. So he was, the closest he came to telling us what he thought was in his 1846 campaign for Congress. He ran against Peter Cartwright, who was a Methodist minister, who accused him of scoffing at religion. And in response to get the votes, Lincoln wrote up a paragraph explaining to the voters his views, and he said, I would never scoff at religion. It's true I don't belong to any church, but I would never make fun of anyone who did, and I would never expect people to vote for anyone who scoffed at religion. Now, he says he doesn't scoff openly. I should use the word precisely, because as a lawyer, Lincoln was careful with words. And he says, I don't scoff openly. He leaves the possibility, maybe behind closed doors, he says, I just don't buy all that formal theological stuff. But he did have his own very strong religious views, for which the best evidence near the end of his life is, of course, the second inaugural address, when he interprets the Civil War as God's punishment to both North and South alike for the sin of slavery.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hi. I'm been a longtime member of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Urbana on Green Street, and we claim that Lincoln did in fact attend that church when he was in town, you know, cases at the Urbana courthouse. Now, there, at that time it was, get this right, it was a Universalist, not the combination of Unitarian and Universalist, just Universalist. And they were somewhat non-traditional, I think you could say more enlightened, actually, in their beliefs, and they were also flexible and open so that you didn't have to follow a strict dogma. Just thought I'd toss that in.
Okay.
Well, I think it's entirely possible that Lincoln would have attended a church like that when in town. There's, as I said, he did attend church, later the Presbyterian church in Washington, D.C. during the war. There's no obstacle to attendance without actually joining. There is also a tradition, though, in many denominations, there are people who've written stories over the years that Lincoln was secretly baptized in, and now you fill in the church of your choice, in one denomination or another, or a similar vein of stories runs that he was about to be baptized, had made that decision on Good Friday in 1865, but of course he went to the theater that night, and his life ended before he could make his profession of faith, as he was just about to do. All these stories conveniently lack any objective witnesses to prove any of them, and they all usually fit with the religion of the person telling the story.
Interesting. Is the listener still there? Want to follow up? Or?
No, that's quite
okay.
Enough.
Well, thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Gerald Prokopovich. He is the author of Did Lincoln Own Slaves? And Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln. If you have a question you've always wanted to ask about Lincoln, give us a call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You've pretty well got past the most frequent question, you know, did Lincoln own slaves? I have 2 points. One is, what's the next most frequently asked question? And the second one is, do the questions themselves reveal a deficiency in what's being taught to, say, high school students in American history? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank
okay.
you.
Well, let me start with the second question, because the what people are taught in high school, I think, is often a source of consternation for those of us many years beyond high school. We think, what are those kids not learning today that we learned? But if one goes back, almost every generation has the same complaint, that the kids today just aren't learning the good old-fashioned way. They're not learning what we need to know. It's probably true that students aren't learning as much about Lincoln. They might not be learning as many traditional myths about Lincoln. They're probably not getting as many truths about Lincoln as they might be getting also. But there's a hunger in the public to learn more. Lincoln himself educated himself for the most part. He had limited formal education. And the people who go to museums and ask questions, people who listen to this show and ask questions, people who buy books or watch the History Channel or just spend their time educating themselves about history are where real education takes place anyway. And if our schools can implant at least an interest in doing that, then they're doing all right, and hopefully they can do that. As for the most frequently asked question, at the Lincoln Museum, by far the most frequently asked question of visitors when they came through the front door would be, which way are the restrooms?
Very good. Now, before I take the next call, I want to ask you, as a historian, what are your hopes? You are a member of the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Commission Advisory Committee. What are your hopes for the bicentennial celebration?
Well, I hope it would do maybe what I just alluded to in terms of arousing people's curiosity, getting people to read more, to think more, to look up answers to questions, to do some Googling or library searching or whatever it is they want to do to find answers. If we can just make people aware that Lincoln's legacy is worth discussing. Lincoln and his views on race, as we've already discussed a little bit this afternoon, were complicated. He did say things that don't fit the modern multicultural view, but it's a misunderstanding of history to take him out of his time and view him through the lens of our time. And if we can start to look at what he really said in his time and evaluate his positions on those questions, we might be able to start some conversations about race today that need to be conducted. So I hope it will serve as a way of bringing people, of making Lincoln continually relevant as we go into the 21st century.
Let's take another call, a listener in Normal, line 4. Hi.
Yes, I would just like your guest to comment on how Lincoln handled taking all these fantastic casualty counts, and I just can't imagine being in that position and if his will to just see that the North was victorious and I guess the Union saved, but waking up every day with these casualty counts, I just can't imagine. And I wonder if your guest would comment, does he think that any other president could do that, could accept that and go on?
Well,
I'll take the answer off the air.
That's a great question.
That's a very powerful question. There's no doubt that Lincoln felt the weight, and the easiest way to see this is to look at any photograph of Lincoln from 1861. He was one of the youngest people elected, in spite of his nickname Old Abe. He was 51 years old when he was elected. And look at those photos and then compare them to the photos of 1865, the ones taken in February of that year. And the toll of war is so plainly etched on his face. It's clearly taken more than 4 years out of his life, more like 40. One thing he did during the war was every other Friday, perhaps it was, what he called the Butcher's Day, he would get all the court-martial records brought to him for soldiers who were going to be executed for sleeping on duty or running away in battle or otherwise violating the Code of Military Justice, whatever they had done. And he would review all those cases. He had left a standing order. No one was to be executed until he had reviewed the case. And he said he would find any excuse he could to pardon someone. Especially what he called the leg cases, men who ran away in battle. Their hearts were willing, but their legs were weak, and they ran away. He would find some way to commute their sentences. And he said it made him feel good that he knew he had brought joy to some family where their boy had been saved. It wasn't much. It was a drop in the bucket compared to the slaughter on the battlefields. But it gave him some relief from the toll that was being taken, that he could try to diminish it in some slight way.
Did he ever feel that the war would be lost, that the Union would fail?
He thought it was pretty close to that. We know this in 1864, in August of 1864. That was an election year. He was running for re-election. The battles had turned into absolutely bloody stalemate in Virginia, the Overland Campaign, the Battle of the Wilderness in Spotsylvania, Cold Harbor, had cost thousands, tens of thousands of casualties. Sherman was supposed to be attacking Atlanta, but was stuck in the mountains of North Georgia, couldn't seem to get any closer. It looked like the war was going to go on indefinitely. And he wrote a secret memorandum, what was called the Blind Memorandum, gave it to his cabinet members to sign without reading, to endorse his position, in which he had written that it appears and has appeared for some days that the administration will not be reelected. And then he knew he would have from November, the election, until inauguration in March of his successor he would have just about 4 months, he said, to do anything he could to try to save the Union, because the new president would be elected on terms of peace and would have to let the Union break apart. So there was that time in August 64 when he really thought things were at their last extreme.
Yeah, and it was called the Blind Memorandum because the people who signed it?
They were not permitted to read it. He gave it to them as a folded piece of paper. It was a way of saying, you're with me or not here. You're with me with blind loyalty or not. And they all signed it. They had come to know him well. Doris Kearns Goodwin's excellent book, Team of Rivals, describes the relationship Lincoln had with his cabinet in great detail. And by 1864, those who were in the cabinet had come to respect and recognize Lincoln's great qualities as a leader.
We've got a couple of other callers who would like to talk with you this afternoon, so let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm also from the Unitarian Universalist Church, and this is a follow-up to the other caller. And I've been working on the history of the church as we're coming up to 150th anniversary of the local Universalist Church. Of course, in 1961 they did merge, but when it was just Universalist, the according to the earlier history that was written that I'm going to be quoting here, they said that in the early years they met around the areas of the courthouse in Urbana because they didn't actually have a building yet, and so they would either meet in businesses or on the courthouse lawn. And that was during the time frame, sometime after 1859, early 60s, that they, says, during these early years, they claimed Abraham Lincoln as a visitor. When he was criticized for having attended a Universalist service, Lincoln replied, "Parson, I used to think that it took the smartest kind of man to uphold and defend Universalism, but now I think differently, for I believe it is the easiest doctrine to defend I have yet heard." And I guess it makes sense to me that even though he wasn't really a member of the church, even if, you know, he did visit, that he would be in line with their beliefs because it was an early liberal, view, and they did a lot of work for the abolition of slavery. So for what it's worth, that's what I have to report.
Well, thank you. That's a very interesting observation, and it's certainly consistent with what we know of Lincoln's religious views.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Bourbonnais, line two. Hi.
He received his commission in the Black Hawk War from Jefferson Davis.
Davis was in the war at the same time. He wasn't actually commissioned by Jefferson Davis, but he may have been commissioned by Robert Anderson, who later commanded the Federal garrison at Fort Sumter. Davis was there in Illinois as part of the Federal war effort, but Davis and Lincoln's paths didn't cross.
Oh, okay, that was my next question.
No, Mrs. Verena Davis, in her memoirs, wrote that they did. She stretched things a little bit. One thing that comes up repeatedly when you study Abraham Lincoln is you realize everybody wants a piece of Lincoln, whether it's a church or a town or an ancestor. Everybody's got some story or wants to have a story that connects them to Lincoln, even Jefferson Davis.
Okay, well, that certainly makes sense. What is the latest thinking on whether or not he had Marfan's syndrome?
That is a question that was very much asked back in the 1980s when the public first learned about Marfan's syndrome. That's a genetic condition that manifests itself in extreme height and large fingers and long, spidery fingers and toes. The thinking is still where it's been for a while, which is you can only find out by testing Lincoln's DNA. There are bits of bone and other fragments left over from the assassination in a museum in Washington that theoretically could be tested. There are blood-stained bits of things that could be tested. But to do so, you would have to destroy them in the process. And many historians, myself included, think that is not an appropriate thing to do. Maybe the technology will change and we can test them non-invasively in 5 or 10 or 20 years.
How would that have affected him?
Well, that's the other point, is that it wouldn't have affected him. He wouldn't have known, certainly, that he had this condition, so it wouldn't have made him act any different. Marfan syndrome sometimes results in sudden, unexpected death, but he would have had no premonition of that. So it really would not change our understanding of him as a historical leader in any way. and thus might be one of those things we could put in the category of private and just not worry about
it. Yeah, it's the, you know, you do come to the question, why should we care, in a sense, you know?
I think that that's an example. Now, people have asked about Lincoln's depression. Joshua Wolfshank has written a wonderful book about Lincoln's melancholy, as he calls it. That affects his decision-making,
right,
and that relates to him as a political leader.
Exactly.
It's worth studying. Lincoln's genetic illnesses, there was another illness he may well have had called Lincoln's disease that affects descendants of Lincoln's grandparents. There are no direct descendants of Lincoln himself left alive, but his grandparents' descendants still have this, many of them. But again, because it didn't affect him or his behavior, as far as we know, it's not something the historian says needs to be
settled
necessarily.
Yeah. Very interesting. There we have to leave it. Boy, the time has just flown by.
Oh, it has.
I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, and I hope that you'll come back and visit with us again in the future.
Well, thank you, Celeste. I enjoyed every minute.
Take care. Gerald Prokopovich has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He holds a law degree from the University of Michigan, his Ph.D. in history from Harvard University. He chairs the history department at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. He is the author of All for the Regiment, The Army of the Ohio, 1861 to 1862. He's written many other articles, and his latest book is Did Lincoln Own Slaves? And Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln, the publisher Pantheon Books.